Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host. We are going to be taking an excursion about the battle space of what I think of as the war for the free world. And I'm very pleased that we have to kick off our tour one of the most accomplished reporters and observers of the scene, Eric Schmidt of the New York Times, a Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter there who covers terrorism and national security issues. He is the co-author with his colleague Tom Shanker of Counterstrike, a book about one of the subjects that we want to visit with him most immediately. Namely, Eric, today in the paper you have above the fold, the lead article, Al-Qaeda's number two said to be killed in a drone strike. Tell us about this character, Abu Yahya al-Libi, what we know about him, and what confidence we have that, in fact, he was killed by effective action by a drone-delivered attack.
Abu Yahya al-Libi is a significant figure in the al-Qaeda hierarchy in Pakistan. He's of Libyan descent, and his late forties really from that older generation of leaders, including Osama bin Laden, who really came up through the ranks and was an important figure. He gained particular notoriety about 6 or 7 years ago when he broke out of the Bagram prison in Afghanistan and later bragged about it on videos. And really, that really kind of launched his career both as an operational figure within the core al-Qaeda leadership as well as one of its chief propagandists. With the death of bin Laden last May and then another key figure, Atiya, Libby moved up quickly to the number two position behind Ayman al-Zawahiri. And in that position, he essentially was the general manager of day-to-day operations for al-Qaeda in Pakistan, and then also played the increasingly important role of kind of interlocutor with the other al-Qaeda franchises around the world, those in North Africa, in East Africa, and perhaps most important, in Yemen. So his death, if it's true, would be a significant blow, yet another blow, really, to the collapsing core leadership of al-Qaeda in Pakistan. American officials are fairly confident this drone strike on Monday in a village in North Waziristan killed al-Libi in a compound without, apparently, according to the American officials, injuring anybody else. So they've been having him under surveillance. They'd actually apparently injured him last week in an earlier strike. He was wounded. And so the prospects were that he had been tracked to this other compound nearby. They'd watched and monitored to see when there might be the reduced risk of civilian casualties, and then took yet another strike.
Well, this is obviously an impressive story of American intelligence and the lethal effectiveness of these drones. It's also a credit, I think, to President Obama for pulling the trigger to take this guy out. You quote at some length in your piece today, Eric Schmidt, the chap we're going to be visiting with next, as it happens, Bill Roggio of Longmoor Journal, making a comment which I'd again like to take stock of with you, namely that this is not necessarily that big a deal, important as it may be to remove this particular individual, that there's more bench depth to al-Qaeda, and that in any event, al-Qaeda is not the whole story. What's your reading of this, and do we expect the administration to be overselling the implications of it?
Well, I think Bill is right to put this in the proper perspective, and clearly the death of bin Laden last year and some other high-ranking al-Qaeda officials in Pakistan, and now the death of al-Libi, really signaled the fact that the core al-Qaeda leadership, that is the leadership that fled Afghanistan after the 9/11 attack, response to the 9/11 attacks, has been really decimated. And their ability to organize and plan and launch attacks against the United States has been greatly reduced. What I think Bill's point was, and this is a good one, is that over the past decade, there have been a number of these affiliates, these franchises that Al-Qaeda has sponsored and inspired. And they now, particularly the franchise in Yemen, which is, of course, the one that was responsible for the so-called underwear bomber in 2009, the printer cartridge plot a year later, and then just most recently, the thwarted plot that would have again tried to smuggle an underpants bomber aboard an American commercial airliner and blow it up. It's now looking like these affiliates, and particularly like the Al-Qaeda affiliate in Yemen, is actually more dangerous, poses a more immediate danger to the United States than Al-Qaeda in Pakistan. And these franchises are operating more and more autonomously. So I think it's a good question to ask is, does the death of al-Libi and the crumpling of the core of Al-Qaeda in Pakistan really make that much difference to some of these more autonomous franchises, some of them, including the one in Yemen, definitely have their sights set on attacking the United States and American interests.
Yeah. In that vein, Eric Schmidt, and again, we're speaking with one of the top correspondents for the New York Times, who covers the Pentagon and related national security and intelligence and terrorism matters. We're also witnessing, as you say, in addition to these kind of franchises taking up operations in backwaters of the world, we're seeing some of them, it would appear, participating rather directly in the takeovers of countries. And I'm thinking specifically of Libya and perhaps soon Syria. And at the same time, kind of the mothership of this ideology that Al-Qaeda is trying to promote, Sharia, namely the Muslim Brotherhood, is very much on the march elsewhere, notably, of course, in Egypt. What kind of net assessment, I guess, Eric, might you provide on how this is really playing out? You focused in Counter-Strike on the Al-Qaeda threat, as has the administration, but are we missing a larger forest for the trees, or are we at risk of doing so?
Well, certainly Al-Qaeda is just one of many extremist groups right now that have the Arab Spring in many ways has enlivened. I think, as you've said, what happened in Libya, they've unleashed forces there. You have extremists on the ground vying for control there that are both in Libya and that have spread outside. Tuareg fighters, for instance, who have left Libya armed and have played a significant role in creating more instability in a country called Mali in northern Africa, which is now a great concern. And then, of course, neighboring to that is Nigeria, where there's a new Islamist group called Boko Haram. So even though Al-Qaeda in Pakistan may be on the ropes, its franchises are very much alive and well. There are other extremist groups alive and well. And then, as you point out, there are various groups, whether it be the Brotherhood in places like Egypt or its influence in perhaps Libya, that's still, I think, yet to be determined. But clearly it's very much worth watching as those groups perhaps take advantage of the unshackling of the dictatorships in some of these countries to move forward.
Well, again, it's of concern because I think their goals are the same, and whether there's a material difference in the difference in tactics, as you say, remains to be seen. Eric Schmidt, let me turn quickly in the remaining minute or so we have with you, and doesn't do justice to it, but several of your colleagues have been breaking stories that are relevant to these issues, and just quickly, your thoughts on the revelations by David Sanger in his book and also on the pages of the New York Times about the Stuxnet worm, I guess, but he says it's actually a larger program called Olympic Games. Are there concerns on the one hand that that those revelations may prove actually quite harmful to our security and that in particular might justify or at least be used as a pretext for retaliation?
Well, clearly David Sanger has broken new ground with his book and the excerpt in the New York Times and laying out, I think people had known about the Stuxnet program and that it was probably a program that designed by the Americans and the Israelis to combat the Iranian nuclear program. But he has gone inside the decision-making process to explain both how this program works and the political calculations of doing that. It obviously does raise some issues by kind of laying out, the means, very explicitly, the means through which Israel and the United States are going after this program. It could could invite some, perhaps some retaliation, but this is a whole new world, the world of cyber warfare. And I think all sides are treading very carefully right now, since it is a brand new field, so they're not crossing too many red lines. But I think David did break some very important ground in this, his reporting.
Well, we'll be following it closely and watching with bated breath, needless to say, to see what kind of response there is. Eric Schmidt, thank you so much for taking some time with us, and we'll look forward especially to further information about Libby from you and other sources, and including from our next guest, Bill Roggio, as we talked about. He's got some thoughts on this as well. So stay tuned for that. Bill Roggio, straight ahead.
My name is Sunday Hollis, and I totally lost the cravings for sweets. I totally lost the cravings for bread, even meat. And some people, you know, you would see people say, oh, well, you're eating a salad because you're trying to diet, but you just don't have a taste for any of the junk anymore. And it is so, so, so true. I'm thinking this is something that the celebrities are using. They're just not giving the meta system the credit for it. I've tried everything under the sun, and this is the only product that I have even called the company and asked them, could I sell it for them? This is a product where you can actually use the word awesome. I mean, and it is the whole essence of the word awesome.
Don't wait another minute to start losing weight. Call Judy Singer's The Meta System at 1-800-711-JUDY. That's 1-800-711-JUDY.
The first step in winning a war is to know whom you're fighting. 9 years after 9/11, the U.S. security establishment has failed to tell us. The very words we need to describe the war are being outlawed. We went from the war on terror under Bush to the war on man-made disasters under Obama. Neither identifies the threat doctrine behind the aggression, Islamic Sharia law. That's why the Center for Security Policy assembled Team B, an independent group of national security professionals, including Bill Clinton's Director of Central Intelligence, James Woolsey. The result is a book that challenges the assumptions of the current administration and exposes the supremacist nature of Sharia and the jihad its adherents are obliged to engage in. This report names the names of those responsible and makes plain the mortal peril now posed to America's Constitution, our national security, and way of life. For more information, visit shariathethreat.com or order your copy of Sharia, The Threat to America at amazon.com.
Experts say there's no shortage of crude oil.
There really is no shortage of oil at the moment.
So why do gasoline prices keep going up?
There's all this fear that's out there, and that really goes a long way to making prices go up.
And home prices seem to be headed even lower.
We really aren't seeing any markets that are showing any sustained recovery at this point.
Now more than ever, is this a timeout or a double dip?
It could halt the economy's recovery in its tracks.
1260 WRC. New choice, intelligent talk.
You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back. Well, we've just been talking with Eric Schmidt about the takedown of Abu Yahya al-Libi. We're going to get a slightly different perspective from a man he quoted in his article in the New York Times today, as advertised earlier, Bill Roggio, a fellow I admire tremendously, who publishes one of the most important resources in this war for the free world. He calls it the Long War Journal, and you can find it at longwarjournal.org. He is its managing editor. He is also a senior fellow at the highly esteemed Foundation for Defense of Democracy, contributor through myriad other outlets to our understanding of the war we're in. And Bill, welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. It is great to have you with us, especially today, to sort of make sense and, as I said to Eric earlier, to provide a net assessment, particularly on where we are as a result of this particular tactical success in the long war you cover so well.
Well, thank you, Frank. It's a pleasure to join you. And yes, I think you're asking the right question. You put it absolutely correctly. This is certainly a tactical success in a long line of tactical successes of, against al-Qaeda. We've been killing al-Qaeda's top leaders for a decade now. And yet the group persists, and the group still is plotting to attack the United States, and the group still is able to take over territory, control territory, build strong relationships with its allies. Look, President Bush had a deck of cards or a sheet of al-Qaeda's top leaders, and he would cross them off. And, you know, when we got to 75% of our top al-Qaeda leaders killed or captured in 2004, he declared al-Qaeda defeated or on its deathbed, did the same thing in 2006. President Obama did the same thing in 2009, 2010. They did the same thing after bin Laden was killed. The reality is this is a group that is it has a very strong ideology first and foremost, and it has a wide base to recruit from in the Muslim world. It's even if it's a small percentage in the Muslim world, it can have millions of people to recruit from. And it's, you know, killing its top leadership is good. It puts al-Qaeda on its back foot. It forces it to have a succession. But the reality is they also have a deep bench of leaders who have been waiting in the wings to take control if their leaders are killed or captured. It took us 10 years to kill Osama bin Laden. After 9/11, and you know what? Al-Qaeda had a replacement for him, and they have replacements. Are they as effective? Maybe in the short term, not so much, but in the long term, Al-Qaeda continues to exist, and just killing its leaders, while is not a bad thing, it's not going. We're not addressing the core issues of state sponsorship, of safe havens and ungoverned spaces, or via state sponsorship, and we're not dealing with the ideology, the core problem.
Yeah. Let's dwell on those several points, because I think, Bill, you've captured succinctly what's missing, I would argue, really, from the United States government's conceptualization of the problem, let alone its execution of a war plan against it. We're seeing, and why I use that term net assessment, is to sort of figure out how does this tactical success of taking down a key al-Qaeda operative offset, if at all, the loss of countries to, you know, in some cases al-Qaeda, like I would argue Libya and perhaps soon Syria, or at least to the Muslim Brotherhood, as in Tunisia and Egypt and perhaps Jordan and others in the near future. When you look at this, Bill, from the long war perspective, is there really any comparison that the successes are in fact being wildly overshadowed by the reverses, some of which it seems the U.S. government is actually aiding and abetting at the moment?
Yeah, you know, look, the U.S. government, with respect to the Muslim Brotherhood, is pretty much resigned, and this is both sides of the aisle, are pretty much resigned to dealing with the Muslim Brotherhood. The reality is that the Brotherhood shares the same goals, pretty much the same goals of al-Qaeda, you know, implementing Sharia and, you know, establishing in the global Islamic state as al-Qaeda does. Just al-Qaeda wants to do it by force, but they are ideological bedfellows in a sense. And yes, you know, we are losing ground to this Islamist over global Islamist movement. So kill it, you know, I just look at al-Qaeda as pretty much the vanguard of all of this, the tip of the spear. And, yeah, we're killing some top operational and tactical and strategic leaders of the terror group, but we're not dealing with that core problem. What's going to happen if – I mean, look, even if the Muslim Brotherhood succeeds, say, in Egypt, we'll just use that, and takes control of the government, I mean, are they going to be openly supporting al-Qaeda? Probably not in the open for legitimacy stakes. They want the international legitimacy. But under the covers, they're not going to be operating toughly against this group. And, you know, what happens if al-Qaeda leaders start popping up inside of Cairo? Are we going to conduct drone strikes in Cairo? Is this what the administration is going to do? The drone strikes that we conduct in Pakistan are limited to a small segment of Pakistan in general. I mean, look at where we've killed or captured top al-Qaeda leaders all over Pakistan's major cities. This would be like saying we're going to take care of the Ku Klux Klan, and in order to take out the Ku Klux Klan, we're going to target its leaders in two counties, one in Alabama and one in Mississippi, and then we'll declare the group dead.
Right. Bill Roggio is our guest. Let me just ask you about this, because it's my understanding, and it's something that we actually, I think, lay out in considerable detail in this course that I was mentioning to you off air at MuslimBrotherhoodInAmerica.com, that it's not that the Muslim Brotherhood is opposed to violence in the fulfillment of their goals, which, as you say, they share with Al-Qaeda. It's just that they see the need to use violence when it will be productive, and they eschew it when it's not likely to be, or may even be counterproductive. And so it's very much an opportunistic sort of approach. Milestones, I guess, is what Said Qutb's ideologue has called it. And Bill, I guess what I'm interested in is both your thoughts as to, if that's right, whether, in fact, we're not only watching new safe havens being created for, you know, Al-Qaeda and these other violent folks, but we're actually seeing the underlying ideological threat or doctrine, if you will, metastasizing under our noses. And as I say, being enabled. The Obama administration transferred, as you know, $1.5 billion to the Muslim Brotherhood-dominated government of Egypt recently. And whether that will migrate on to Hamas or to Al-Qaeda or whomever remains to be seen. But shouldn't we be very leery of this kind of embrace of this kind of group with this kind of agenda?
Oh, I couldn't agree with you more. The funding of this group is just, it's absolutely insane. And, you know, again, we're talking about a group who has expressed, you know, affinity for members of Al-Qaeda. Yes, they have you're correct. They have a tactical difference with Al-Qaeda of basically using force, but that's only because of what happened to them in Egypt. Or at least let's use the Egyptian Muslim Brotherhood as the example. They, you know, they made a calculation and said, wow, you know, Mubarak's regime, this is just not productive for us to violently oppose the Mubarak regime. We're going to try for a political course. But, I mean, anyone that thinks that this group wouldn't, if it felt that it could take control of Egypt via violence, it would quickly turn to do so, because they haven't denounced it. They just said, as you said, they've just decided that it was not tactically sound for them to continue to violently oppose the Egyptian regime. We are enabling our enemies by providing support for the Muslim Brotherhood. We're giving them political cover. What we're doing is we're taking a radical Islamist group that does not represent the entire Muslim world, and we're giving them prominence. We're giving them legitimacy. We do the same thing, or, you know, the media pretty much does the same thing with more extremist Muslim groups like CARE and whatnot, by granting them the legitimacy when we want to talk to a Muslim or a Muslim group. We'll bring on CARE. Well, that's the exact same thing that the U.S. government is doing with the Muslim Brotherhood overseas.
Well, and
it's very dangerous and counterproductive.
We have to let you go. I'm sorry with that, but that's exactly the thrust of our course, and I hope you'll take a look at it. It really does make the point that the reason we're treating the Muslim Brotherhood in Egypt the way we are is in part because of the way we have been treating CARE in this country and other Muslim Brotherhood fronts. Bill Roggio of Long War Journal, thank you so much for what you're doing and for spending a little bit of time with us on this very busy day for you, I'm sure. Keep coming back to us, if you will, and at the very least, keep up the great work at the Foundation for Defense of Democracy and Long War Journal.
Go to SecureFreedomRadio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Hi, NBA forward Kevin Durant from the Oklahoma City Thunder. Here with Bugs Bunny and Daffy Duck to remind you to get moving every day.
Because when you get moving an hour a day,
you'll have more energy to do the things you like to do.
And that's a slam dunk.
Whether you like to shoot hoops like me, skateboard, ride a bike,
or dance on your roof, just move it your way.
For an hour a day. Because moving every day puts you on the offense towards a stronger you.
And that makes you part of a winning team.
I couldn't have said it better myself, Bugs.
So be a player.
Be a player.
Get up, play, and move it your way. Check out how to be a player at letsmove.gov.
Head online to get tips on great ways to get moving every day.
You said it at www.letsmove.gov. Let's hear that one more time, Doc. That's www.letsmove.gov. letsmove.gov. A message from the Ad Council and HHS.
This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. The reported liquidation of one of Al-Qaeda's top terrorists, Abu Yahya al-Libi, is a cause for celebration by all those who love freedom and were therefore his sworn enemies. Congratulations to U.S. intelligence for finding him, to the operators of the lethal unmanned vehicle that took him out, and to President Obama for ordering the hit. That said, don't confuse this with an end of the threat from Al-Qaeda, let alone the threat we face from others who share the doctrine al-Libi and his ilk call Sharia. While we are successfully eliminating key operatives in Pakistan and Yemen, Islamic supremacist organizations bent on imposing Sharia worldwide, like the Muslim Brotherhood and its subsidiaries and offshoots, including Al-Qaeda, are taking over whole countries. And that's not progress for our side. This is Frank Affney with the Secure Freedom Minute. Learn more at securefreedomradio.com.
In 1966 in Anchorage, Alaska, a talented child was born. He would go on to be one out of only 11 Alaskans to make it to the major leagues. The odds of him striking out more than 3,000 hitters? 1 in 33 million. The odds of this pitcher being selected to the Major League Baseball All-Star Game 6 times? 1 in 48 million. The odds of this fast-balling philanthropist winning the World Series 3 times? 1 in 3 million. The odds of this man having a child diagnosed with autism? 1 in 110. Hi, I'm Kurt Schilling. Learn the signs of autism at autismspeaks.org. Autism is getting closer to home. From 1 in 5,000 only 20 years ago, today 1 in 110 children are diagnosed. Early diagnosis can make a lifetime of difference. Autism Speaks. It's time to listen. Brought to you by Autism Speaks and the Ad Council. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
What are you doing?
Filling out a loan application.
I can help you get approved, you know.
Really? How?
With this.
A bag of sand?
It's not a bag. It's a pouch. And it's not sand. It's credit fairy dust.
Credit fairy dust?
Yes. I sprinkle some fairy dust on the application, and your credit rating magically improves.
There's no such thing as the credit fairy.
An unbeliever now. But what will you think when your loan is approved?
I'll think my credit score improved because I paid my bills on time, kept my credit card balances low, and only opened a new card if I really needed it.
It's the dust.
It's sand.
Don't deny the credit fairy.
There's no magic to improving your credit, but there is help, and it's free. Go to creditfairy.org. A public service announcement brought to you by the Consumer Bankers Foundation, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights Education Fund, and the Ad Council.
Hi, this is Frank Affney. You're listening to Intelligent Talk on WRC 1260 in Washington, D.C.
Now more with Frank Affney.
Welcome back. We're joined by one of my all-time favorite people, not only as a guest on the show, but as an author, as a commentator, and as a friend, Mark Helprin. He is a world-class author of myriad incredibly interesting publications, including one of my personal favorites, A Winter's Tale. And Mark is a man that I wanted to visit with specifically for the purpose of getting a historical perspective on D-Day, whose anniversary we commemorate today, a very important day, of course, in the history of World War II and of the free world, but one that has insights and lessons for us even today. And Mark, we were talking off air about the fact that I interviewed yesterday Dr. Arthur Herman, who's written a new book about America's industrial base and the marshalling of it that made D-Day and the successful outcome in World War II possible. Talk to us a little bit about your take on that and related issues in this anniversary of that very important day.
Sure. I mean, the first thing you have to realize is that nothing to do with the industrial base, but look at the differences between then and now. We had, on the eve of D-Day, we had a commander who took full responsibility, even, you know, essentially offering to resign, taking absolute full responsibility according to the precepts of honor. We don't have that much anymore. We had a president who spoke to the country offering a prayer and a beautiful one. Can you imagine that now? And we had a country that was completely united and determined. You know, 99.99999%, I think the only conscientious objector was Robert Lowell. The enemy was formidable. The drama was great. We had air superiority, not complete air superiority, as such as we have today in the wars we fight today. But we were very well matched by the Wehrmacht. And the question is, can we do this in the future if we had a major war to fight? And the answer is, no, not in the near future. And then one would ask why? Because we have let our industrial base go to seed. At that time, it took a few months, just a few months, literally. They would put people in a hotel room and say, design a new fighter plane, and they could do it in a matter of weeks. It took a few months to get a first-line weapon system designed and into production, and then we produce it in great numbers. Now, it takes, for example, with the F-22, which we just threw away, it takes 20 years because of the greater complexity by orders of magnitude of the weapons that we use. Now, we understood this at the beginning and through the end of the Cold War. We know it now, but now we are still allowing the industrial base to decay and disintegrate and go to seed. There's a perfect example of this, by the way, Frank, which is in the Nuclear Posture Review. This is the Obama administration's look at nuclear problems and the laying out of policy. And in it, they say that their goal is to abolish nuclear weapons completely. In other words, we would rid ourselves of nuclear weapons, but we would keep our industrial capacity, the capacity for manufacturing them. So in other words, and when I read that, I practically fell out of my seat because if some country hid 100 nuclear weapons in caves and then suddenly broke out and said, all right, we've got them, and we're going to launch unless you do what we say and you have to do this and that, we would turn on the lights at Oak Ridge and start to manufacture them. That's totally, totally insane.
Yeah, but Mark, it's if I may, it's worse than that. And again, we're speaking with author and commentator Mark Helprin. It's worse than that in the sense that that was the previous nuclear posture review. The one that is now apparently in draft or being developed for the president is one that says we're going to get rid of up to 80% of our nuclear deterrent, and as best I can tell, is not concerned about maintaining the defense industrial base, the nuclear infrastructure, the weapons complex, as it's called. And so what we're seeing is really in stark contrast to what you and Arthur Herman have been talking about in terms of the immense capacity of America to provide for not only its own defense but that of the free world. It's being ripped up by the roots by the present administration, and I fear that unless we awaken to this quite quickly. Indeed, we have a press conference earlier today in which we unveiled the latest documentation of what is happening to both the defense industry and to our economy as a result of the cuts that are being made already and those that are now in prospect with sequestration. And let me just ask you on that point, Mark Helprin, because you've given so much thought to this, what kind of world are we likely to find ourselves in if the United States persists in this kind of dismantling of its military capabilities at the very moment that, as you've documented, Russia and China and other enemies are building theirs?
Well, of course, the weaker we get, the more we tempt an enemy into adventures or into actually pursuing with force their own legitimate interests or what they see as their legitimate interests. And we might, in the future, in the near future, have to fight a major war, unlike what we've done in generations now. And we're losing that war right now because of this long lead time, which we've understood throughout the Cold War, and we understand it now, but we're just almost deliberately ignoring it. What is the root of this? The root of this, apart from actual hostility to the United States, to its history, to the Constitution, to our ideals, and you can't get into that really because then you'd have to address people's motives, which is very hard to do. But there is a certain mentality which is apparent, and if it could speak, this is what it would say. I just walked up Connecticut Avenue, I had a latte, I bought some new pajamas at Brooks Brothers, and I didn't see a single terrorist, Viet Cong, or Chinese submarine. Everything's fine. why spend money on the military? That's the heart of it. That's really the heart of it, because that's the thing that if you have someone who is or a group of people who are hostile to the United States and have been since the beginning, hostile to the Constitution, siding essentially with our enemies because they said, you know, we've got to be on the right side of history during the Cold War, those people will find common cause with people who have no hostility but who yet don't see Chinese submarines when they drive to Walmart to buy some stuff. And that's
some Chinese stuff in all likelihood.
Yeah, some Chinese, and that's the connection. That's where that's the bridge, which is, in other words, you could have someone with not necessarily ulterior motives, but somebody who is basically hostile to the enterprise of the United States, connecting with the general public via the bridge of, look around you, everything's fine, we don't have to prepare. It's the grasshopper and the ant.
Yeah, don't worry, be happy. Let me ask about this. You mentioned terrorism, and of course today we're celebrating not only the anniversary of D-Day, but the takedown, apparently, of one of the top al-Qaeda commanders. Does that make a difference, Mark Helprin, in the great scheme of things? Are we properly understanding the nature of this war? Is it more than just terrorism that we're up against? And if so, are we clueless as to what it's going to take to defeat it?
Yeah, well, yeah, of course we are misunderstanding. Since the very beginning, at the very, very beginning, which is, by the way, decades ago, when if you look in the pages of the Wall Street Journal, you could see that the Wall Street Journal and I in the pages too were advocating striking the terrorist infrastructure back in the 80s when I began to write for them. But since the beginning and since the recent beginnings after September 11th, I assumed stupidly that we would have a tremendous irregular infrastructure with, you know, commandos and SEALs and Delta Force, etc., to hit the terrorists where they were in small operations. No question about it. But that this would be in addition to and subsidiary to a much greater power with which we could more or less direct the nations that support these people not to. And we tried that in Iraq and Afghanistan, but we bungled it tremendously. We're still bungling it. We're bungling it even worse. The bottom line is that it is not a criminal enterprise solely. If it were, then all we would need would be the FBI and the local police department. It's supported by not only nations, but by an entire segment of the world's population.
Yeah. With this, Mark Helprin, we have to let you go. I'm afraid we are at the end of our time, but this is the starting point for the next conversation, which we hope to have with you very soon. Mark Helprin, among others, terrific books, the new one forthcoming, In Sunlight and in Shadow. Thank you for joining us. We'll talk with you again very soon. Next up, Jim Hansen takes us with his boots on the ground perspective into the very war that we've just been talking about with Mark Helprin. Straight ahead.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
I was able to lose the 80 pounds I gained due to pregnancy. It was pretty easy to eat whatever I wanted and not think about it.
The Meta System from Judy Singer has been helping make weight loss easier for a quarter century.
My husband's grandmother used it 20 years ago to lose weight for a wedding and said it was the only way to go.
The Meta System also has an excellent support staff.
They were very supportive. The first time that I ordered the product, they called me and suggested that I order a lower dosage to begin with. They didn't want me to jump the gun right off the bat, and it was nice to know that they actually cared.
And the weight loss is so dramatic, people wonder.
With the Meta System, I've got many questions about how I managed raising a baby and working full-time and lose the weight and eat whatever I wanted.
People who use it recommend it.
I suggested the Meta System to my mother, and she has lost 30 pounds.
Learn more about weight loss with Judy Singer's The Meta System by calling 800-711-JUDY, 800-711-JUDY. The Meta System from Judy Singer, the powerful, all-natural way to lose weight. 800-711-JUDY.
Hey, this is Frank Gaffney. My day job is running the Center for Security Policy, which each weeknight brings you this program. But Secure Freedom Radio is just one of the important contributions the Center makes to the common defense. We call our team the Special Forces in the War of Ideas. Like the real special forces, we strive to be agile, creative, and highly effective in identifying threats to our country and how they might best be countered. We can't do all this without you, though. Also, like the real special forces, ours need ammunition. And in the war of ideas, ammo is money. The Center is a nonprofit, tax-exempt organization. Contributions to its work are tax-deductible and an important investment in your security and freedom. Find out more about the Center for Security Policy and how you can help keep its special forces team in the fight by visiting securefreedom.org. Many thanks.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
I have held the same mirror for 13 years.
I have been decorated with purple dinosaurs, baseball teams, and football helmets.
I have witnessed 33 Thanksgiving dinners and one wedding proposal.
I have tiny notches marking the growth of three children.
I have caused a learning disability.
I am the reason that a fifth grader simply can't sit still.
I am responsible for a five-year-old's rage.
Just because you can't see lead paint doesn't mean it's not on walls, doors, windows, and sills. Today, lead paint poisoning affects over 1 million children. If your home is built before 1978, your family could be at risk. Let's make all kids lead-free kids. Log on to leadfreekids.org or call 800-424-LEAD.
I am the reason a child has trouble hearing.
If your walls could talk, what would they say?
Brought to you by the Coalition to End Childhood Lead Poisoning, EPA, HUD, and the Ad Council.
In Washington, Hugh Hewitt has the diagnosis.
They don't understand the need for speed.
Oh, we'll get to it. Don't worry. We'll get it done. Open amendment process, blah, 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 blah.
Not in the least bit clued in to the sense of urgency, but I don't think the Beltway is.
I'm just beginning to think it is a Beltway disease.
Kind of an invisible wall separates them from what the people think.
The Hugh Hewitt Show, weeknights from 6 to 9 on 1260 WRC. New Choice, intelligent talk.
If you're a veteran of Iraq or Afghanistan, like me, coming home can be harder than expected. I felt a little out of place, but it turns out I wasn't alone.
At IAVA.org, there's a free online community of thousands of OIF and OEF vets who've got your back here, just like they did over there. So now, I'm never alone. I can get the resources I need and talk to tons of people who understand where I'm coming from.
Whether it's navigating the GI Bill
or VA hospitals,
managing the transition home, or meeting people you can share stories with,
you'll find it at IAVA.org.
Even if it's just everyday stuff,
like getting tips on where to find a nice sweater for my dog.
Did he just say that?
Really? What?
Okay, maybe not that, but everything else. No matter where you are, Iraq and Afghanistan Veterans of America is there for you. Join our community at IAVA.org.
We've got your back.
Brought to you by Iraq Afghanistan Veterans of America and the Ad Council.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back. We're joined, as we are each week, by our friend Jim Hansen, a former U.S. Army special operator, the guy we turn to for his acumen, both as an observer of the scene, an essayist par excellence, among other places, at black5.net, and as a man who brings us the boots-on-the-ground perspective on all of this war for the free world business. And we've been talking throughout the program, Jim, of course, about the big news overnight, namely the reported takedown of a top al-Qaeda operative by the name of Abu Yahya al-Libi. How important, in your estimation, is his liquidation, assuming it happened, and that we're hearing from the Obama administration, well, this is kind of a decisive blow to al-Qaeda, is it?
Well, it's good news. I mean, let's be perfectly frank. I am second to none in loving to do the dead tango dance every time we return one of these guys to his component molecules. But in the end, you know, they are not a centralized organization. You can't simply kill al-Qaeda by killing a bunch of terrorists. You know, they are a franchise organization, and you get any group of like-minded jihadists in any unstable part of the world, and they run up the black flag, and they're al-Qaeda wherever.
Yeah, yeah. So, and there's a lot of that going on.
Obviously, you know, outside in the Arabian Peninsula, all over the Arab Spring. You know, there's black flags running up all over the place. I think the problem is looking at it as if we were fighting a group with a set number of people and, you know, we killed 80% of them, we're done. Well, no. Unfortunately, it's a war of ideas. It's a battle of civilizations, as you and everyone else on this program is well aware. And the problem is our administration doesn't want to look at it that way, and they're using things like Libby's death and Bin Laden's death as campaign ads as opposed to actual, you know, pieces of a strategic initiative to fight the war of ideas and win the battle for our freedom.
Yeah. Jim Henson, let me come back to that question about spiking the football in a moment, but just staying with this issue, as a special operator, you have talked with us in the past about the uncertainty as to whether this practice of killing these guys, as opposed to trying to take them and interrogate them, which is essentially now off limits under the Obama administration, is going to actually help us take down Al-Qaeda, let alone this larger enterprise that adheres to this ideology that animates them and others called Sharia. Give us your quick thought on what is the current your assessment of this idea that killing them is an adequate substitute for the intelligence that they have that we ought to try to extract from them.
Yeah, well, the simple answer to that is it absolutely is not. I mean, the last time I checked, you know, a puddle of protoplasm, you know, sitting in a destroyed vehicle is not likely to tell us what their plans are for the next operation. So, I mean, at some level, killing too many of these guys without interrogating them actually makes us less aware of what could potentially happen. You know, if there are plans in place, if they come compartmentalized at all, which we know they do, then simply killing people without attempting to extract intelligence, without attempting to connect the dots, and simply taking the easy way out because you don't want to capture them, you have no plan for where to take them and keep them, you know, because you're closing Gitmo. And we've neutered our interrogation program to the point where we can pretty much ask them what kind of tea they want. That is a recipe for putting a blindfold over our ability to know what our enemy is doing.
Right. Deeply troubling. And again, coming back to this point that you made in passing, Jim Henson, the compromise of our tradecraft and our intelligence capabilities and practices that has come about as a result of the Obama administration's, well, in the words of the president, spiking the football or otherwise, you know, blabbing what they should not be revealing, is the kind of thing that makes me wonder whether we're not actually, as you say, greatly exacerbating the dangers we're facing, notably this revelation, as we talked about with Eric Schmidt earlier in the program, about the cyber warfare activities that our country has been engaged in under the rubric of what's come to be called Stuxnets, but maybe better described as Olympic Games, we're told.
Yeah, I guess Obama lost out on his chance to bring the Olympics to Chicago, so he decided to possum a ride on George Bush's program that he developed with the Israelis to go ahead and attack Iranian centrifuges and their nuke program. I think talking about that in the way they have is just part of their pattern of using our national security as the one thing Obama can claim he's done right, and so consequently is telling his people to tell everybody about. And it has absolutely made us less secure. It has absolutely let our enemies know what we're doing and what they can do to us. I mean, the Stuxnet thing was a brilliant way to attack the Iranian nuke program by attacking a glaring weakness in it, the industrial controls that run it. We put, you know, software in there that told those controls to do things that destroyed large chunks of their industrial capability and their ability to build nukes. Well, guess what? We use those same industrial controls, and we have next to no ability to secure those. It's probably the weakest link in our cyber defenses is the fact that we have thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of industrial controllers, which are mini computers that are now connected to the internet that people can access, and then any reasonably competent hacker can take down and attack dams, attack power grids, attack any number of pieces of our infrastructure. And it's something we definitely need to address, and it's something the Obama team now is showing a light on. And hopefully, I guess, that light will, you know, push people to start securing this stuff. If not, we may see some amazingly devastating damage done to our own country, and that's unfortunate.
Yeah. Jim, just very quickly on that point, there are some who are speculating that having disclosed this activity, we now basically have provided proof positive and a basis for retaliation by the Iranians, or perhaps hackers operating at their behest or in their support, at least. Does that particularly trouble you, or is that something that's a problem under all circumstances?
Now, the Iranians have some brilliant engineers and scientists, and it doesn't even take a high level of computer science capability to attack these things. They were never, industrial controls were never designed to be connected to the internet, to be run online. There should be an air gap between them and the world. You know, as in, you have to walk up to the control and program it or plug something into it. In order to make things more efficient, we've connected them all. We've made them part of company networks and in many cases attached to the public internet. That is a vector of attack that is amazingly open right now and could be devastating in the amount of damage, like I said, a reasonably competent hacker can do. And trust me, the Iranians have, and other folks have, reasonably competent hackers. So it's a glaring weakness in our cyber defenses, and it's something we need to address.
Yeah, and if they don't have them, they can certainly go out and rent them from the open market, I'm sure. Jim Hansen, let me quickly finish with one other topic. You spent time in uniform in the Special Forces in the Pacific. We've been treated to Leon Panetta, the Secretary of Defense, making a tour of the region, still underway, making promises about an increased presence of the United States at the same time that we're seeing substantial, in fact, vast cuts in our military programs, budgets, and capabilities. What's your net assessment of where we are as a result of this trip?
It's a lot of wonderful talk. If we were going to, you know, if we had the Reagan Navy, you know, maybe we could do that. I'm pretty sure that we don't. I'm pretty sure that, you know, we have cut our ability to be an expeditionary force, to be the power in that region. Everybody in the region knows who the power is there. It's China. And to the extent that we can be an alternative, I guess some folks are going to, you know, play nice with us, and we'll do what we can. But I think our ability to be, you know, in the way we're the global policeman everywhere else, China is making a major push in that area, and we are not that strong an alternative to them. So it's the right answer. I just don't believe we have the resources to deliver on Panetta's promise.
Yeah, and I guess that's really the key question, is having spent time with those folks in the region, you know so well, Jim Hansen, that we're dealing with people who are practical. If nothing else, they may choose to arm up themselves in order to try to contend with a real and present danger that we're not there in sufficient numbers and credibly to help them contend with. Or they may simply make a separate peace with the Chinese, which is not going to be good for our interests in the region for sure. Jim Hansen, we have to leave it at that. Thank you for your insights, as always. We look forward to visiting with you again next week, and we look forward to talking with the rest of you again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Affney. Thanks for listening.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.